Senate Judiciary Committee, Friday, May 7th, 1999, 1 p.m., room 343.
Oh, she's highly compensated. Highly compensated. She gets a great reference from me, though.
Oh, isn't that big? Yeah.
Welcome to Senate Judiciary on a Friday afternoon. To explain why the agenda looks so long, initially I was supposed to complete Senate bills by today. I've been extended a week. And this is a day we don't normally meet, but it's open for us, and I put several things on the agenda and just to make sure that we could try to meet the deadline and move a few bills today. However, some amendments are not ready, and some witnesses were not able to appear today, and some bills were not going to work. So let me talk to you about a few that won't come up today. Senate bills 721, 722, 723 dealing with PERS will not be heard today. I will bring them back next week, and we've circulated the amendments, and I'm getting feedback and comments. So I would say that probably Tuesday would be the earliest, and the bill we're going to concentrate on is 722. Let's see. Senator Q-Tub had a bill today on private prisons. I think it's 1257. It will not be heard today. But I'm missing three members. Senator Nelson is chairing his committee. Senator Q-Tub's in another committee. And Senator Tarno is in his district today. So there will only be the four of us. So 1247 will not be heard.
There's only four of us?
There's only four.
We can do it.
We can do it.
We can do whatever we want.
That's what he's afraid of, I think.
We can change the state of change the state of Oregon.
I understand. But you still need four, you understand.
Yeah.
Then, I'm trying to remember. I've had so many conversations. 841. Also, Q-Tub would like to be there for that, so we'll postpone that.
They're both on Monday.
And that'll be on Monday. Pardon? 9 what?
937.
937. Oh, yes. We just got the amendments back on genetic privacy. An easy read for anyone who's interested. The good news is we have agreement among the work group except the Oregon Medical Association.
Right, I was going to say.
And so we will reschedule 937 for?
Monday.
But that then, Bill, I think we'll be ready. Pardon? 1005. We're not going to have that today. So they're still working on that in that work group. Is there any other, Bill or Ann, that we won't be doing so that we don't hold people?
Didn't you mention something about juries and let me go to the number?
Oh, yes. Senator Starr's witnesses from Hillsborough. On the one dealing with the exclusion from jury if you're pregnant.
1304.
1304. We will not be hearing that today. We'll schedule next week. He will contact us when those witnesses are available.
You know who you are, Senator.
Did you
know that?
I know that. We've already talked. And she's enjoying having a few quiet moments here before we call her bill up.
So. The last one is 1008, which is the other genetic privacy bill, which I understand won't be used anyway.
Right. We will be using
937.
So, we've done half of the agenda already. And now, we will commence with Senator Gordley's bill. And we have some amendments on that, I believe.
Well.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Avell Gordley, Senate District 10, and I must say I do appreciate the fifth senator from the Capitol looking out for me. He's been doing a good job of that since about 1991.
Did you hear that?
Yes.
Aren't you jealous?
Jealous?
Yes.
Yes, I'm jealous.
And Mr. Chair, let me also say that I appreciate very much your patience and the committee's patience while we surveyed agencies for their experience using interpreters in their current adjudicatory hearing. The measure before you is Senate Bill 38, and we're looking at what we're proposing allows us to have flexible enough language in the Dash 2 amendment before you to encompass the administrative law judge discretion that Administrative Law Judge Terry Mizak had raised in the initial public hearing back on March 16th. And to articulate or make clear the legislative intent for the record, I would like to state that the hearings officer designee language of the Dash 2 amendments can be interpreted flexibly enough to allow the clerical functions of the Employment Department hearings and the Workers' Compensation Board maintenance of its docket while reinforcing the primary role of the hearings officer and the hearings officer discretion. Another issue raised when surveying the agencies was the need to coordinate the performance oversight of certified interpreters, particularly those with those agencies that have internally contracted lists of interpreters. And I believe this coordination will also serve to address the issues raised by Judge Mizak. I'd be happy to answer questions about the Dash 2 amendments and the overall intent of Senate Bill 38. I thank you again for your consideration of this bill, which is a priority for the Access to Justice for All Committee.
Senator, on the workers' comp issue, as I understand the Dash 2 amendments, it does protect the fact that the interpreter has to be qualified and come from that pool. But the hearings officer can remove an interpreter and have another qualified interpreter appointed, or exactly what does the Dash 2 do in that regard?
With your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to call up Kathy Rhodes, if I may, for some technical assistance.
You may.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Kathy Rhodes. I'm with the Office of State Court Administrator. What we did was look through the statute as is, and everywhere where it says court, put in also hearings officer or the hearings officer designee. I had the opportunity to look at the survey results that Senator Gordley's office provided us, and it does appear in a lot of the administrative agencies that the office staff are the ones that arrange for the interpreter. But Judge Mizak's concern was then how does she, as an administrative hearings officer, get to say, is this person qualified or not, and be able to disqualify them or replace them with another interpreter. Let me take a moment. I find the section that addresses that.
You want section 4 on page 2, lines 3 through 7.
3 through 7 talk about the hearings officer is the one who appoints the qualified interpreter. Hearings officer or the hearings officer's designee. Then also on page 3, about lines 14 through 24, talks about if a party or a witness is dissatisfied with the interpreter selected by the court, the hearings officer or the designee, let me find that. They can substitute for another. And it also talks about how the substitution is made, and it says, you know, unless the court, the hearings officer, or the designee has substituted the interpreter for cause the other person may need to pay. There's another spot too. I think where the address is. I was going to find it. Yes, and also on page 6 in lines 15 through 25, it talks about the court hearings officer designee may not appoint any person under this section if, and if you drop down to 23 through 25, the person is unable to work cooperatively with the judge, the court, or the hearings officer.
Well, going back to the situation with the workers' compensation, who would make the initial appointment of the interpreter?
From how I believe we've written this, the hearings officer is the one who can make that original appointment of the interpreter, but it also says the hearings officer is the designee. So in those agencies where it is set up as an administrative function and the hearings officer believes that that is fine and they don't have any difficulty with that, then it can continue on as an administrative function. But the hearings officer then can go in. If the hearings officer wants to take an active role and be the one to, you know, proactively pick the interpreter as such, that they can do that.
Okay.
As Senator Gordley said, it allows some flexibility.
Well, my concern is one that the interpreter who's selected, of course, is qualified.
Right.
And through our court process, we have people that go through a certification process to be designated. And it sounded like the agencies were using a similar process in order to make sure that the interpreter was qualified. And then if the hearings officer, if the agency appoints, that's fine. If the hearings officer is unhappy with that appointment or there's some personality conflict or some reason not to use that interpreter,
right,
this allows the hearings officer, and then for cause, to remove the interpreter and bring in another qualified interpreter.
Right. And from what I understand, what we've been able to put together here, it would take care of that situation.
And, Mr. Chair, just to add some additional clarifying information, joining me is Sharon Hill, a legislative assistant on my staff who has put a great deal of work and energy into this project.
Mr. Chair, just to be real quick about my understanding when I surveyed the agencies, the Workers' Comp Board, just for everyone's understanding on the committee, originally the list is prepared by the contracted interpreters are set up by the board, but the list is then given to the claimant's attorney to select the interpreter. I don't know that that's been made clear initially here, so that in that specific agency, the claimant's attorney is the first one that gets that choice. As you may know, in terms of the workers' comp hearing, some of the pre-settlement negotiations and those sorts of things may happen that the judge doesn't get involved until that latter portion. The discretion that Kathy talked about is true once you get to that hearings piece. That's a different sort of way in the employment division, is that it's totally clerical, and it's, again, the hearings officer designee. So I've talked with the folks at the Workers' Comp Board in terms of how we would like to say for the record about the designee being able to be the agency maintaining a docket, but also about the clerical functions that are still at the direction of the hearings officer, if that helps.
So, Mr. Chair, we're not pointing out in the bill how that designation is actually made, though, in terms of whether or not it's the hearings officer's designation or whether or not, by virtue of the fact that they are a hearings officer in an agency that has that administrative process, that's a given. The bill is silent to that.
But. Other questions? Then the chair would move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 38. Discussion? Objection? Order?
Senate Bill 38 amendment.
Thank you very much.
Correct.
38 is amended to the Ways and Means Committee to do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Our court moves Senate Bill 38 is amended to the Ways and Means Committee to do pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Order? Senator Gordley, probably at some point you and I should go, I would imagine, visit.
Yes.
Senator Representative Westland, if he gets, I don't know who will be assigned these in Ways and Means, but the two should be assigned together. Okay. All right, Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm
The next bill, the first bill on the agenda is 1104, but it is Senator Brown's bill, and she just left her meeting. May I suggest that we do 941? I can see three witnesses sitting in the audience. This is really thrilled to Ways and Means. So
all right.
It'll be our first hearing on the bill.
The signal.
Oh, I just got a signal from the bullpen on 68.
All right. Well, open. Is this a public hearing on 68?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. We'll open a public hearing then on Senate Bill 68. And I would invite Brad Plank.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, and I appreciate you very much scheduling this bill. Let me explain that the original bill was an interesting topic, but its substance was folded into Senate Bill 42, which has now been signed by the governor, but it has a very interesting relating clause that we would like to use to solve a problem that Judge Tavares brought to us the other day.
This is a gotten
and I haven't seen the final amendments, but I can tell you what the substance of them, I hope, is, and I believe it is. Okay. Let me explain the problem. A number of years away, back until a few years ago, we had circuit and district courts, and district courts were mandated to have small claims divisions. As you all know, in 1998, we consolidated the circuit courts and the district courts, and that made the circuit courts be mandated to have small claims divisions. We've got a few circuit courts that have never had small claims divisions before, and one of the reasons in some instances is that there was a justice court that had a small claims division that was in the same building in some instances. And we have in Baker County a situation where Judge Pope and has his circuit courtroom right across the hallway from Judge Larry Cole, who's the justice of the peace. Judge Cole has a very extensive small claims division, and neither one of them are sure why they should open another small claims division in the circuit court across the hallway. So they call and ask if they're both mandated to have small claims divisions currently. They ask if we could solve this problem. It's a problem that arguably could affect the four or five counties where justice courts were grandfathered in to allowed to continue having justice courts in the same city as the circuit court, and there aren't many of them. So we drafted up these amendments to gut and stuff Senate Bill 68 to where a circuit court is located in the same city as the justice court. They can reach agreement so that only one of them has a small claims division, and that would solve Judge Cole and Judge Pope's problem.
Thank you.
And I can answer any questions.
I don't think we'll probably have any, and as soon as I have a quorum back, we'll go to work session.
Thank you.
We'll now come to the public hearing on Senate Bill 68. Move to the public hearing on Senate Bill 941 and invite Mark Gardner, Phil Chadsey, and Bob Yundell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Gardner. I'm special counsel to the Attorney General Hardy Myers. 15 months ago, he directed me to form a task force to look at issues surrounding the civil commitment process. A total of 24 persons served on the task force, representing almost all stakeholders in the mental health field. The task force looked at three broad issues: confidentiality, scope of the state's ability to involuntarily intervene in the life of a mentally ill person, and resources for the system. In all the work of the task force, save one area, there was a lack of consensus. The one thing everybody agreed was that the system lacked adequate resources. This bill emerged from the work of the task force and was unanimously endorsed. Senate Bill 941 would create two 15-bed secure residential treatment facilities to serve adults with diagnosis of mental illness and alcohol or drug problems. The facilities would be located in Multnomah and Lane counties. People with these dual diagnoses are an increasing segment of the state's mental health population. Although there are programs for people with mental health problems and programs for people with alcohol or drug problems, residential services for persons with dual diagnoses in these areas are almost non-existent. As a former circuit court judge who handled hundreds of civil commitments, I can confirm this from my personal experience. This bill would also fund outpatient follow-up services, create an advisory committee on dual diagnosis, and require an evaluation of outcomes of services to be reported to the Legislative Assembly. This bill would serve approximately 75 additional adults yearly with dual diagnosis at a cost of about $2.9 million in general funds during the biennium. The impact of the bill would include a decrease in acute hospitalizations, in the number of mentally ill persons that would become involved in the criminal justice system, and those who, because of severe mental illness, become homeless. Additionally, the state hospital would have an additional structured residential resource for discharging long-term patients in need of intensive dual diagnosis treatment. Finally, it would decrease the number of civil commitments. As a former legislator, I realize how difficult it is to find the financial resources for the existing meritorious programs of state government, let alone new programs. However, this program is desperately needed. There are events occurring in this building and elsewhere that may free up additional funds for public health programs, and for that reason, along with the merits of the bill, I ask the committee to send Senate Bill 941 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Last week, or maybe it was last week, we sent Senate Bill 942 down, which dealt with what we call the mental health probation. The same idea with a little different group of clientele, but that, and with two pilot projects in Lane and Deschutes County. But the idea was, it's been tried in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where keeping the mentally ill out of going in the prison system, and it had a very high success ratio on recidivism, 10% versus 70%. And it was less expensive than sending someone to prison. This program has some of the same concerns and elements, but because it specifies the dual diagnosis and whatnot, it seems more concentrated. I was just curious, did you have any input or involvement in 942?
Mr. Chairman, I was the co-chair of the committee that developed 942, and I testified on that bill in
That's
this
right.
committee last week.
On that corner, I remember now. It's only been a week. Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, I agree.
Have you had any, I think probably asked this before as well, but do you have any kind of assessment of how much money would be saved? Does it cost so much more to hospitalize people or send into prison than to deal with their problems at a lower level?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I don't know that, but I think that that's part of the purpose of the bill is so that we can basically try some approaches to see if we can save some money in these particular areas. And I can just say that from my personal experience as a former legislator and as a judge, that this would be money well spent.
Chairman, just to follow up with a comment, that was the one thing that really struck me about our tours of the prisons, was the extent to which they have become the final kind of treatment option for people who are mentally ill who could very well be treated in other settings much more effectively. So this is a good step.
I'm Phil Shadsey. I'm president of the Multnomah County chapter of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, which is a group composed largely of mentally ill persons and their family members. I'm here today to speak on their behalf. The problem of dual diagnosis, as many of you probably realize, is that mentally ill people often don't have much insight into the nature of their illness and don't take their medications, and as a result end up self-medicating. And they usually self-medicate on either alcohol or some other type of mind-altering drug. And this is designed to deal with that problem. You need to deal with the drug problem before you can deal with the mental illness problems, and it requires hospital beds to do that, and we strongly urge that this bill pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center, and our role in both this work group and in certainly in other areas is advocating for client rights. this is a bill and this is a program that is highly needed in this state, both in terms of serving the people who have the dual diagnosis problem, but also as a public safety measure. One very important thing to remember is that part of the stigma of mental illness is being labeled as someone who is violent. And there's been lots of studies that take a look at that and see whether that's true or not. Most that I've read seem to indicate that there isn't necessarily a direct correlation between a mental illness and violence, but when you add substance abuse to mental illness, then there is a correlation, and a strong correlation. This type of treatment program could go far to ensuring public safety as well as getting people the treatment they need, and we support it.
Thank you, and I think you're aware that in the interim, the Judicial Committee will take a look at mental illness from a broader vision and come back to the 2001 legislature with some suggestions, hopefully. Questions? Thank you for testimony. We'll move the bill as soon as I regain my quorum.
Thank you.
Is there another bill we can do?
Chair, we have one more bill for public hearing. That's 1104, but it comes from Senator Brown. And there was no one that signed up to testify.
Okay.
I do see the Oregon Youth Authority here because it does apply to them. So Bob Jester's here, so I don't know.
Well, is Senator Brown just out in the hallway?
I think
he's speaking with Bill Wyatt and Chema. I think it'll go quickly after we get our quorum back, after we've conducted a public hearing. Will we open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1104?
I will testify.
Call Senator Brown to the stand. We'll make her testify, and then we'll do it.
Mr. Chair, this is on top of a bike ride this morning, so I am a bit winded. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7. I introduced this bill as a result of a difficulty we've had in Southeast Portland with the siting of a juvenile residential facility. And what the neighbors' largest frustration was the fact that they didn't receive notice that the facility went into the area. The particular facility moved into an area in inner Southeast that already has a very large proportion of social service agencies in the neighborhood. So the residents are concerned about losing the residential quality of the neighborhood. I proposed several bills. This is one of them, and the one that I could not find anybody to object to. What the bill does is require Oregon Youth Authority and SOSCF, when they're dealing with adjudicated youth and placing facilities in neighborhoods, to set up an advisory committee to inform the residents that the facility is coming into the neighborhood. As you'll see from the bill, the Department of Corrections is already required to go through this process, and it's my understanding that it basically has worked in terms of providing the community with the information. One of the things we're seeing, at least on the east side of Portland, is that we have a large share of juvenile beds on the east side, and we're not seeing a share on the Senator Burdick side. The reason for that is an economic one. Property on the east side of the river is cheaper than on the west side of the river. But the reality is, it seems appropriate that these facilities be distributed somewhat evenly throughout the entire city. So here's our proposal. The one addition we would like to make, and I've been advised by someone much smarter and wiser than I, that it may be best to do this on the House side. The issue was raised whether or not this would apply to ongoing
facilities, and it's my intention that it apply only to facilities cited after the date of the act. And we would like to receive clarification on that and an amendment on the House side. The amendment suggested is that it applies to OIA and SOSCF facilities defined in ORS 169.690C that are proposed on or after the effective date of this act.
The chair would prefer you do that on the House side.
I thought you might think that.
Questions for Senator Brown? Thank you for testimony.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1104.
Authority here because it does apply to them. So a lot of gestures here, so I don't know.
Well, it's a Senator Brown just out in the hallway. I believe he's speaking with Bill Wyatt. It's Chamo. I think it'll go quickly after we inform back now because we've conducted a public hearing. Will he open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1104?
I will testify.
Call Senator Brown to the stand. We'll make her testify and then we'll do it.
Mr. Chair, this is on top of a bike ride this morning, so I am a bit winded. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7. I introduced this bill as a result of a difficulty we've had in Southeast Portland with the siting of a juvenile residential facility. And what the neighbor's largest frustration was the fact that they didn't receive notice that the facility went into the area. The particular facility moved into an area in inner Southeast that already has a very large proportion of social service agencies in the neighborhood. So the residents are concerned about losing the residential quality of the neighborhood. I proposed several bills. This is one of them, and the one that I could not find anybody to object to. What the bill does is require Oregon Youth Authority and SOSCF, when they're dealing with adjudicated youth and placing facilities in neighborhoods, to set up an advisory committee to inform the residents that the facility is coming into the neighborhood. As you'll see from the bill, the Department of Corrections is already required to go through this process, and it's my understanding that it basically has worked in terms of providing the community with the information. One of the things we're seeing, at least on the east side of Portland, is that we have a large share of juvenile beds on the east side, and we're not seeing a share on the Senator Burdick side. The reason for that is an economic one. Property on the east side of the river is cheaper than on the west side of the river. But the reality is, it seems appropriate that these facilities be distributed somewhat evenly throughout the entire city. So here's our proposal. The one addition we would like to make, and I've been advised by someone much smarter and wiser than I, that it may be best to do this on the House side. The issue was raised whether or not this would apply to ongoing facilities, and it's my intention that it apply only to facilities cited after the date of the act. And we would like to receive clarification on that and an amendment on the House side. The amendment suggested is that it applies to OIA and SOSCF facilities defined in ORS 169.690C that are proposed on or after the effective date of this act.
The chair would prefer you do that on the House side.
I thought you might think that.
Questions for Senator Brown? Thank you for testimony.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1104. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1104. Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 1104 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Objection. Objection. So ordered. That motion passes. Senator Brown will carry. Next.
941.
The chair would move that 941 be referred to Ways and Means as a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objection. So ordered.
59.
We'll go to 68. If I've got it here. We're in a work session on Senate Bill 68. The chair would move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 68. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. The chair then would move Senate Bill 68 as amended to the floor to pass. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. And anyone care to carry this?
I'm sure.
Thank you. All right. Since I have Mr. Taylor here, why don't we go then with a public hearing on Senate Bill 59.
You mean work session, Mr. Chairman?
Work session on Senate Bill 59.
We've had many of
work session and hearing on this
bill. I'm nervous. Bill that would never go
away. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've already adopted the dash 3 amendments, which relate to the issue of guns in courthouses. We adopted them, I think, probably back in early March. And what you have before you today are two sets of amendments, the dash 13 and the dash 14, which relate to the issue of buses and guns and buses and mass transit vehicles. The difference between the two are the dash 13 are off the unlawful possession of a firearm statute. The dash 14 are off the public building statute. For the dash 13, any and all offenses would be Class A misdemeanors. For the dash 14, the first offense would be a Class A misdemeanor. After that, it would be a Class C felony. The other difference is that under the dash 14 amendments, which is, as I said, under the public building statute, a peace officer may examine a firearm possessed by anyone while on the mass transit vehicle. Both bills have the exemptions for firearms on a bus if it's in a locked case and no ammunition.
And a Class A misdemeanor does not mean that you, under federal law, that you'd be prohibited from owning firearms.
Chair, members of the committee, the only time a Class A misdemeanor would prohibit you from having firearms on the federal law would be if it involved domestic relations violence, and this does not, so it would not include a Class A misdemeanor.
And so, just tell me one more time the distinction between the dash 14 and the dash 13.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, directing your attention to the dash 13. It amends 166.250, and that is a person commits a crime of unlawful possession of a firearm if the person knowingly, and then goes down to see, carries any firearm on a school bus or a bus or a train operated by a mass transit district. Then going over to page 2, it sets what it does not apply. Who possesses a firearm on a bus or train operated by a mass transit district, if the person does not possess any firearm ammunition, if the firearm is a new firearm and its original packing on not a new firearm, the firearm is in a case or who is licensed to carry a concealed handgun permit. You go then to the dash 14 amendments, going to page 1. Notwithstanding subsection A of the subsection, intentionally possessed a loaded or unloaded firearm while on a mass transit vehicle is a Class A misdemeanor. Otherwise, it's a Class C felony. And then you go further down on that amendment over to page 3, and it has the provision relating to the fact that a peace officer may examine the weapon. Now, as far as a public building goes, anyone, if you have a concealed weapon, you can carry a gun in a public building except for courthouse. So that under this particular provision, if you were to adopt the dash 14, if someone were to be on a mass transit vehicle, carried a firearm and had a concealed weapon permit, they would not be in violation of law.
Okay. We're in work session, then the chair would move to dash 14. Discussion? Objection? Order. The chair then would move Senate Bill 59 as amended before it is passed. Discussion? Objection? Order. I will carry.
We're going to miss this bill, aren't we?
I know. Okay. So we'll now go into a work session on Senate Bill 1168, Senator Courtney's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You should
should have before you the dash two amendments. This, I hate to use the term in this particular bill, this is a gotten stuff, and it relates to unlawful, the selling of dogs and cats for animals. And I think that Senator Courtney mentioned that he may have a one-word amendment to his amendment. I'm not sure I have to leave the room while he suggests that amendment, so, you have to suspend the rules.
While he's looking for the word, I just have to say, between all the work you spent last session on saving the dogs and this bill, the dog lovers in the world must really appreciate you.
Mr. Chairman, so do the cat lovers.
Well, they probably also own guns, so they're conflicted. Okay. Senator Courtney.
I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1168.
The dash two.
Dash two.
Okay, I got to find the dash.
I think I have to.
There it is. I got them. All right, Senator Courtney moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1168. Discussion? Hearing none, so order.
You are now, how are you going to do the technical amendment?
Well, I would treat this technical amendment as a typographical error in that the dash twos include the word trap. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And consequently, Senator Courtney wishes to remove that error and delete the word trap from the dash two.
And the following comma.
And the following comma. Very good. So then it would be.
And you suspended the rules to do that?
And we suspended the rules to do that. First of all, we, Chair moves to suspend the rules to correct this typographical error. Objection? In this order, Senator Courtney then moves on the dash two amendments to delete the word trap on line four and the comma that follows. Discussion? Objection? So
move Senate Bill 1168 is amended to the floor to pass.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 1168 to the floor do pass. Discussion? Objection? Order.
I think I'll carry that one.
I think you will too.
Well, yeah, let me look at this. I haven't had my conversation yet with this is Senator Hartung's bill.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Let's move it.
Well, I've got to talk to Senator Hartung. I'm not going to create a Class C felony. Isn't that what it does?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I'm not going to create a Class I know that. But I just don't like creating felonies.
Well, you know, we'll amend it now.
Yeah.
Why don't we do that?
Can't we get the typographical
Well, should I go outside?
No. I want to extend a hard time of courtesy of what I want to do to the bill before I do it.
Okay. So, Mr. Cherry wants to put it on for Monday. Or?
How many do we have on now for Monday?
Oh, high 20. Wednesday?
Wednesday is fine. Thank you.
So, Chairman, you got another week extension?
Yes, I do. Of course, we have to complete 555 and PERS within that time frame.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll then go to open a work session on Senate Bill 1075. As you recall, we had testimony from Karen Menace and Maureen McKnight, and they proposed some dash two amendments.
That's right, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. You have the dash two amendments in front of you. So this bill does require a court that has awarded parenting time for an abusive non-custodial parent to make adequate provision not only for the child but also the custodial parent's safety, and also creates a rebuttal presumption that is not in the best interest of the welfare of the child.
Here I go, dash two amendments.
Thank you.
What's my rendition of it?
Sorry, Bill.
Senator Brown moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1075. And I believe Judge Harrell also testified in favor of this. Discussion? Objection to order. Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 1075 as amended to the floor be passed. Discussion? Objection to order.
Senator Brown, Mr. Kennedy?
Could be.
Carry on with Senator Cuthorn.
You know, I think Senator Cuthorn may want to carry it.
Yep.
Okay.
If you could check, because I arranged that.
It was a bill. So.
Right.
So yeah.
Let's do that. Okay. And that was Senator Cuthorn. Senator Cannon, do we have any more hearings left today?
Not that I know of, Mr. Chair.
Which one?
It's not coming out anymore. It'll take more coffee.
Well, there won't be any. Let me ponder for a moment.
You got a grasp for them all for a moment.
But I have been very consistent in not over-criminalizing.
Everything else?
Well, life is filled with inconsistency.
Yes, that's true. And I have been inconsistent.
Consistency is the hobgoblin of all mine.
I mean, well,
we can always pull it back, you know.
I know, but that takes time and effort. Oh, we're done.
We did a pretty good job as you guys did. Got that baby back. Something remember this time around.
Yeah.
That was a great amendment, too, by the way.
It, well, to reach consensus is a bill. My screw up causes to reach consensus.
This is a better bill.
Yes, very much. 841.
That's you put, agreed to put that over until Monday because Senator Chuka would not be here. That's the different price.
Okay, good. Let's see. 941 was done. What about 1075?
Isn't that the one we just did on the...
Yes, we just did that. All right. 1168, we're done. We're done.
We're done?
We're done.
You're
hot. You could have done 1066, I know. I want to talk to Senator Harkin about it.
Okay.
Do you want to make, or do I have?
I do want to make them happy. I still maintain my trouble principle.